Nice to see Ainsley and Barbara coming back again. That's my pleasure. Nice to see everyone, of course. And this is it's a bit strange because what we're going to look at is the Brahma Jala Sutta. Yeah, and this is a sutta that I started on about 2 years ago. But we haven't had many sutta classes, or I haven't been to many sutta classes over the last 2 years. So for that reason, has been a long break since the last one. And this is the fourth installment of the sutta. We had three installments already. And the sutta basically is about wrong view. Yeah, I did wrong views on the path and showing us where we can go wrong. And for this reason, it is the first sutta in the entire Pali Canon. It like sets out the dangers of wrong view, just like right view is the first factor of the Noble Eightfold Path. In a sense, this sets out, if you like, what is right view and what is wrong view. So you have the beginning, the starting point of the Noble Eightfold Path. And the sutra starts out with a long section on virtue, yeah? And then the Buddha, after this long section, he says that this is not really what you should praise the Buddha for. Shouldn't be praised for virtue. And then he comes to the thing that you should praise the Buddha for. Because what you should praise him for is precisely his right view. Because that has to do with the insight into the nature of reality, yeah, into the idea of the self and non-self, the nature of Nibbana and all of these kind of things. And that is where Buddhism and the Buddha is special. And if you look at some of the sutras that discuss what makes Buddhism different or the Dhamma different from any other religion, it is always this idea of non-self that makes the Buddhist teaching special. And this is what the Buddha claimed. He was the only one who really had that insight into non-self. So we had a look at the first four wrong views. We looked at that last time, which is last time is about 9 months ago or something. I'm not sure when it was. And these wrong views that we had a look at last time, they are the eternalist doctrines, eternalist teachings. And in there, these teachings are like teachings like the self, the atta, the self and the world are like a mountain, top, yeah, barren. Barren means there's no kind of, they don't produce anything, they just stand there, barren. Solid, immovable, like eternity itself. And these are like the eternalist views. And these views, as pointed out by people who have an understanding of the philosophical background to these things, these views are very similar to what the Vedanta teachings are. Vedanta, Advaita Vedanta, are the teachings, kind of the meditation teachings in Hinduism or Brahmanism. Yeah, the kind of Vedanta is the teachings that came out maybe a few hundred years after the Buddha. So these are, in a sense, the Buddhist answer to these Vedanta teachings, saying that the Vedanta, which posits a self, a permanent self, and a permanent world, and these things being equivalent in some way, they are not correct according to the Buddhist teachings. They are based on a misunderstanding of reality. So these are the first four views, and now we come to four other views, and these views are all about the past. They're called views to do with the past. It doesn't really matter what they're called, but in large part probably because it is about recollection of the past, that's how these views come about. Now we come to four views that are related to the other ones, and these are called views of partial eternalism. Is the volume a little bit on the high side, or is it? Is it okay? It's okay. Yeah, good. Okay. It's too loud. Yeah, it sounds louder than it was on Friday night for sure. Maybe is it possible to reduce the volume just a little bit? Just so, yeah. But okay, we'll just see what happens. So these are the views on partial eternalism. Can you still hear me? Okay. Yeah. Okay. Good. Didn't do anything bad. And the idea of partial eternalism is that instead of positing everything as eternal, there is an aspect of reality that you posit as eternal. Yeah? And this is as problematic, as we shall see, as eternalism itself. So let's have a look at this. And as usual, I will read through the suttas very slowly and gradually and comment on these things as we go along. So partial eternalism from the Brahma Jala Sutta, Brahma's Metta. And this is what the Buddha says. There are some ascetics and Brahmins who are partial eternalists, who assert that the self and the cosmos are partially eternal and partially not eternal on four grounds. Yeah, so ascetics and Brahmins, these were the religious people at that time. These were the people who had doctrines that were relevant for spiritual practice or religious practice in one way or another. It kind of includes all spiritual people. And that's why you find it's a very standard phrase in the suttas, the idea of ascetics and Brahmins. The Brahmins being the orthodox religious people, and the ascetics being the heterodox ones, the kind of the outliers, the ones who were a bit on the outside of society, a kind of acceptable society, and of course the Buddha belonged to those ascetics. And they assert the self and the cosmos are partially eternal on four grounds. The cosmos here is loka. It quite literally means world, yeah. And just as the word world in English is has many different connotations to it, the same thing with loka in Pali. It means like my personal world. It means the world, like humanity. It means the world in the sense of the earth. It means also the world in the sense of the entire cosmos. And here it means something like the cosmos, the universe, if you like. And it's interesting, in the suttas they always have this self and cosmos going together like this, yeah? They assert the self and the cosmos are partially eternal. Sounds a bit strange from our point of view, yeah? Self and the cosmos, why are these kind of put together like this? Yeah, the self is here, the cosmos is out there. What's the point here? And the point is that from these a Brahmanical point of view, or the ancient Indian point of view, yeah, especially Brahmanism, the cosmos, and this is true for Advaita Vedanta, the cosmos really is just a reflection of Brahma, yeah, the Brahma, the God, who stands behind the entire world as it is. And you could say that the cosmos, the world, is almost like a reflection or our visual understanding of that Brahma. Yeah, so the Brahma is like the all-encompassing spirit of the world. And our self, the kind of inner, what they are talking about, the inner idea of a human being, is also just another aspect of that Brahma, but it's somehow limited within our body. But when you die, you kind of get, you know, you kind of merge back with that Brahma again afterwards. So this is why they're talking about the self and the world, because from their point of view, these two are actually just two sides of the same coin. The self and the cosmos are eternal and partially eternal on four grounds. There's four reasons why people would come up with this kind of doctrine. There's probably many more reasons, but these are the reasons that are mentioned here. So what... Yes, please.
Just so that I understand.
Yeah. Yeah. It depends. There's all kinds of things. Yeah, these are any kind of religious person, whether based on jhana samadhi experiences, or based on logic, or based on anything really. The idea is that these are just the doctrines that are asserted by religious people in general. And they can assert these things on any kind of foundation. Yeah? So that's what it is about. So these are just views in society. However they come about, doesn't really matter how they come about. The origin is kind of irrelevant. But certainly you're right. An important aspect of this is samadhi experience. In that sense it is different from you know, from Greek philosophy, etc. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. But here they have this additional dimension which includes meditation experience, but also rational thinking as well. Yeah, they had kind of everything. Yeah. So the microphone. Okay, good. Yeah, please. I forgot to say, please just stop me at any time and just ask questions. Yeah, so see what happens. Please. means that some things are eternal, some things are not eternal. Yeah? Yeah. Okay. We'll see that in a second. So see, Lin was just asking, what does partially eternal mean? How can something be partially eternal? It's a good question, because it sounds like an oxymoron, but it does mean that some things are eternal, some things are not. Yeah. Yeah. So what are these four grounds on which you assert these kind of teachings? Go away. Okay. So there comes a time when after a very long period has passed that this cosmos contracts. As the cosmos contracts, sentient beings are mostly headed for the realm of streaming radiance. There they are, mind-made, feeding on rapture, self-luminous, moving through the sky, steadily glorious, and they remain like that for a very long time. So, this is kind of part of the ancient Buddhist idea of the world, yeah, how the world works, if you can call this, if you like, Buddhist cosmology, yeah. And what is very interesting about the Buddhist cosmology, and which I always found kind of astonishing, yeah, is that some of the things the Buddha says, it just looks very similar to modern ideas of cosmology, yeah. And some of it is just uncanny, it's just so kind of extraordinary. In fact, I wrote an essay about this a long time ago. I gave a talk about this, and an essay kind of evolved from that. And you can look it online. I think it's called The Buddhist Cosmology or something like that. It's on the BSWA website. And this is one of those little pieces of information that you find in the suttas. Yeah, after a very long period, it says here, the cosmos contracts. Yeah, so this what this seems to be saying is that, well, now the cosmos is expanding, but after a very long time, it will start to contract. That's what it seems to be saying, yeah? Otherwise, kind of the sentence doesn't make much sense. So this kind of gives you the feeling that the Buddha knew that the cosmos was expanding, or evolving, at least. The Pali word is not very, it's very hard to know sometimes what these Pali words exactly refer to, but the idea of the Pali word here, which is used to contracting, is sangvatati. Yeah? And sangvatati, vat, is the same word we have like in to volve, yeah, like evolve. The root word volve means like to roll on. And vatati is a similar kind of idea of rolling. Yeah? And sang is together. And vivatati is a part. Yeah? Evolution and devolution. Exactly the same kind of idea that you had in ancient India as you have in modern English. So there seems to be here some idea about the cosmos, which are very modern, yeah, which existed in ancient India. And it's like you wonder, how could the Buddha have known these things? Yeah, it's kind of really weird. Has he stolen the idea from modern cosmologists? It's impossible. Yeah, he lived 2,500 years ago. Couldn't have done that. So it's kind of, for that reason, it's very strange. So I speculate a little bit about where that comes from, why that is there, in that talk I gave a long time ago, which is also found in that essay here. So this is kind of just the first minor point here. But then comes this idea that when the cosmos contracts, sentient beings are mostly headed for the realm of streaming radiance. And streaming radiance here is the abhasara loka in Pali. And abhasara, abha, means like a stream of exactly what it says here, the radiance which is streaming. That's kind of the idea of a abhasara. And this world is a world that is equivalent to the second jhana realm in suttas. Yeah, so this is a very, very high realm. So these beings are headed for that realm. Why is that? Well, because when the cosmos contracts, the cosmos gets destroyed. Yeah. So you have to kind of head somewhere where you go beyond the destruction of the cosmos. So here you can see the ideas of, you know, seem to be very similar to the idea of a big bang, and then a kind of a contraction again afterwards, maybe call it a big crunch or whatever, yeah, where the cosmos gets destroyed and then kind of reappears again. You get things, little things like this, which seem to be very much in line with how
some modern cosmologists view the universe. It's one of the ways that cosmologists think about the universe these days, is this idea of the bouncing universe, which expands and contracts one after the other. And here we see this idea, because when the universe contracts, and it gets destroyed, then beings can no longer exist. You can't exist as a human being when the earth burns up, obviously. You can't get reborn here anymore. Or maybe this would be considered the hell realm in that case. Nor can you really be born as an animal, nor can you be reborn if the earth completely disappears. You cannot be reborn as any kind of being which is related to the earth. You see in the suttas, the way they talk about they have something called the loka dhatu. Loka is world, dhatu is like an element, And the loka dhatu, world element, consists of the sun, the moon, the earth, And then it's like a solar system. And then you find all the realms of gods kind of belong to that system, up to a certain level, up to the Brahma loka. And then beyond the Brahma loka, then you are outside of that. So all of these realms must get destroyed because they belong to the earth. So they will all disappear. And only those realms that are beyond this conflagration as the cosmos collapses, only those realms will remain. And this is one of those realms. And that's why the beings go there. This is kind of the idea behind this. Yes? I'm coming to that one. That's next. It's coming now. And this kind of leaves some interesting questions. How can you get reborn in this realm if you are a dodgy character? Because there are some dodgy characters around, especially characters already reborn in the ghost realms and hell realms. Where do they all kind of get reborn in the second jhana? It sounds very strange. How can you get reborn in such a place if you have a defiled mind with all kind of dodgy things going on there? And this is a conundrum. I asked Ajahn Brahm about this, he said that I didn't find his answer very satisfactory, I have to admit. So sometimes you just don't know. It's hard to really know exactly what's going on. But Ajahn Brahm's idea was that, there's nowhere else to go, so you have to go there. But to me, that is not entirely satisfactory, because how can you enter a jhana state without having the mental qualities that are commensurate with that jhana state? So I don't usually sometimes when Ajahn Brahm says things, I sort of think, maybe, but maybe not. Not entirely convinced about that one. So I looked at the commentaries, and what the commentaries say is that you can get reborn in a different universe, in another place. That's where you get reborn. Because the commentaries said if you are reborn in hell, it's impossible to get reborn in a second jhana realm. So you go to a different universe. So there are some solutions here. There are some alternative ways of looking at this. But it is a kind of strange passage, and you wonder what is happening. Otherwise, you get a nice holiday from hell for quite a while. It's just kind of the way the universe works. So maybe you have a holiday in Cambodia. Isn't that an old song from the... So it's a bit like that. So that is what is happening here. These beings kind of going into this realms because there's nowhere else to stay. But even mostly is quite strange, right? Because yebuyena is the Pali word, and mostly people go to the second jhana. Usually it's a tiny, tiny minority that have the sufficient karma to go to these realms, But you're right, it says mostly, and then the commentary says, what is meant by mostly here is that those beings who are in higher realms, beyond the second jhana, they don't go to the second jhana realm. If a being is already in a higher realm than the abhasara, than the streaming radiance, they stay in that realm. If you're already even higher, then you don't go. That's what the commentary has meant by mostly here. Are you with me, Bill? they have to be somewhere. They have to be reborn in some kind of realm.
It's really a side issue. It's not really main part of the ideas here. But the idea, what I'm saying, Bill, is that if a being is already existing in a higher realm than the one we're talking about here, then they stay there. They don't get reborn in this realm. It's only these other lower beings that go to this realm. Yeah, that is what is meant by mostly in this case, according to the commentary. Yeah. Possibly, yeah, I don't know. This is the conundrum here, yeah? This is what I can't really say here, yeah. Yeah, all beings there. All beings there, yeah, yeah. 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 Are you brought up? Yeah, okay. Yeah. Yeah.
I finally make the breakthrough, right?
Yeah,
it's the strongest power in the universe anyway. Mm. Nothing but myself can destroy it.
Yeah.
Well, that's still a wrong view, I know.
Yeah.
But the problem is such a powerful force, nothing can destroy it, yeah. But without the Dhamma, right?
Yeah. Well, this is what this sutta sort of says. It says that we sort of all come from there in a certain way. But it's not that we come from there, it's that we pass through there. Yeah, we don't come from any particular place.
But that was, at one point in time, that was where, or if not at higher realm.
Yeah, and this is what it talks about exactly. Yeah.
And without needing to practice meditation, we were all there.
Yeah.
Is that right?
I mean, this is the thing. The problem I find with this is just that I find it very strange that you can get a holiday for free in the second Jhana realm without having the right kind of mind state. To me, it sounds a bit strange, and I don't think we should dwell too much on this, because this may just be an ancient mythology. It may not be taken literally. It's hard to know whether the Buddha means these things absolutely literally or not, or whether he's using an idea that is kind of found in that society, because it's not a core part of what the message that he's making. He's just using this as a kind of background story for a very different message. So it doesn't matter all that much. But it's just interesting, little interesting points on the way in the suttas. Eddie, Wait for the microphone, Eddie, so we can... You're going to get lots of exercise, so you're going to run back and forth.
Thanks for this very interesting sutta.
Yeah.
As I see this, we have to refer... When you talk about this cosmos thing, we have to refer to the 31 planes of existence.
Mm.
Yeah. My interpretation is, it says there comes a time after a very long period has passed, this cosmos contracts, So what I see is it slowly contracts, like the lower realms, slowly disappear, the beings become going higher and higher.
Mm.
We are on the fifth plane, goes higher, till after if you look through the realm of what's, there are no man-made, you move around the sky, all these things, they are higher than the 14th plane, the higher planes.
Yeah.
So gradually, all is not immediately, gradually, we move towards a higher planes.
I think there's probably a lot of truth in that. Gradually, it's just like,
And there's such a plane, I think, I don't know whether I can share or not this thing. I did experience this long time ago.
Yeah.
You know, it's a higher thing, okay, and then you move through the sky, just the, explained in the 31 planes of existence.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Anyway, let's not get stuck too much on this, because otherwise we're going to be here for a long time. But it's just one of those things. So there they are. They go to this realm. It's kind of interesting. It says headed for that realm. It doesn't say reborn. The Pali word is sangvatanika, which means like they're kind of, it means like the heading there. It could mean rebirth, but doesn't necessarily mean rebirth. So it could just mean that they're kind of herded into this place, because there's nowhere else to go, something like that. And there they are, and this is what happens in this realm. You are mind-made, You are feeding on rapture, piti bhaka.
quite nice, isn't it? Feeding on rapture. It's a very beautiful idea, this idea that you, the thing that sustains you in this kind of realm is just the internal pleasure, the internal happiness. That's all you need. And one of the things that make life meaningful is the fact that you have some kind of happiness in your life. If there's no happiness in your life, life is unbearable and you end up committing suicide. There's no point in existing anymore. And of course, as you rise up through the various realms and as you purify your mind, that happiness that you live on becomes more and more refined. And here you are feeding on that happiness. It is happiness that sustains you, the rapture, the piti that sustains you in existence. Kind of marvelous. And of course, then you go even beyond that later on. So you're feeding on happiness, self-luminous. This is what the devas, the word deva is derived from the word diva. Diva means like day, because you are bright, you're brilliant, self-luminous. Moving through the sky. That's another slightly controversial one. I'm not sure entirely how to interpret that one. Second jhana realms, usually you're supposed to be very locked into those realms, so I'm not sure exactly how it is that you move through the sky, but anyway, sounds probably not a bad place to, if you're going to move, might as well move in the sky, I suppose. It's quite quite pleasant. Steadily glorious. What is the Pali? I've got kind of two screens here, just to make sure I have enough computer power. Subhata, exactly. So steadily glorious. This means that you are remaining in glory, is what it means, basically. And you remain like that for a very long time, as you would expect in these high jhana realms. You stay there for long periods of time. Okay, so this is the beginning of this. Everyone hangs out in this realm, the Abhasara Loka, and then what happens next? There comes a time after a very long period has passed that this cosmos expands. Cosmos contracting, then expanding again. It reminds you of something. So you can see here, you have gone through this period of contraction, you come down to some kind of minimum point, and it starts expanding again. And then to be able to deal with that, you have to be like almost outside the cosmos. You have to look at this cosmos from the outside, otherwise you'll be part of that big crunch. And that's why you are in these very, very high realms. So the cosmos expands, and as it expands, an empty mansion of Brahma appears. Then a certain sentient being, due to the running out of the lifespan or merit, passes away from that host of radiant deities and is reborn in that empty mansion of Brahma. There they are, mind-made, feeding on rapture, self-luminous, moving through the sky, steadily glorious, and they remain like that for a very long time. So let's have a look at this particular paragraph. First of all, here we have the time going on here, long, long periods of time, as you would expect with the expansion and contraction of the cosmos. And then after a while, empty mansion of Brahma appears. What does this mean? Well, I don't know exactly what is meant by the empty mansion of Brahma, but of course, as the cosmos expands, as we normally know it, the galaxies start to form, you get planets, you get suns, you get all of these kind of things. And these things might be the foundation for this Brahma mansion. Maybe these galaxies and things that form, maybe these kind of are precisely from the Brahma's point of view, they might be like a mansion of Brahma, And this is one way of looking at this, that this actually is the kind of the hangout of the Brahma. For the rest of us, looks like the universe or cosmos or galaxies or whatever. Another way of thinking about this is maybe to think that an empty mansion of Brahma is to remember that the world as it is very often a creation of the mind. What is the world? The world is how we perceive the world. It is really our inner world which is the world. So because the world is so much dependent on our inner life and our inner experience. A lot of the world is like created by the mind. Yeah, what we see right now, it's a large part of that is a mental creation. We just receive this kind of, possibly this input from the outside. We don't even know what that input is. And this image of the world is created as a consequence. So there's a lot of interaction between the world outside and the mind. So it could just be a mental creation in that sense. So it just arises as a consequence of, Brahma desiring a nice mansion. It's just the same as people here in Perth desire big mansions. Yeah, up in the Brahma Rock, they also want large mansions. It's interesting, isn't it? Humanity, we're all the same. It doesn't make much difference where you get reborn. So I think the Brahma mansion is a little bit more spectacular than the mansions you find in, suburbs, Peppermint Grove. I was here just the other day. I did a wedding blessing in Peppermint Grove on Friday before I came in here. So that's the mansions I saw recently down there. But I think this is just a little bit more spectacular than that. A lot more spectacular, of course. So, this Brahma mansion appears, yeah? The mansion is there, ready to be inhabited, and then a certain being, due to the running out of the lifespan, or the running out of merit. So what is the difference between these two things, lifespan and merit? You can imagine, you can make a lot of good merit in a life, so for example, you make sufficient merit to be a human for 500 years. Yeah, you can think you might be able to do that, but you cannot sustain human life for 500 years. Human life only lasts for about 100 years, so after 100 years you will die, yeah, regardless, because your lifespan has run out, but the merit is still there, so then you will get reborn as a human being again, unless you make some other bad karma in the meantime, of course, but assuming you don't make any bad karma in the meantime, you then get reborn as a human being again, yeah, until eventually that merit is exhausted by being reborn as a human, maybe, five times, 100 years each time, 500 years, and then the merit is exhausted. So there's a difference there between merit and lifespan. Sometimes there are limits to lifespans. Okay, please stop me if I talk nonsense or you can't follow or you have questions or whatever, or you, whatever reason. And so then they pass away. And you fall away from the Abhasraloka and you get reborn in that empty Brahma mansion. And there too, they are mind-made. Yeah, so it's a similar, it's a lower kind of realm, because the previous one is the second jhana realm. This is equivalent to the first jhana realm. But still, you have very similar characteristics there. Mind-made, feeding a rapture, self-luminous, moving through the sky, steadily glorious. And you remain like that for a very long time. Go away. But after staying there all alone for a long time, they become dissatisfied and anxious. Even Brahmas get lonely. Yeah, it's hard to get... We always say that the best way to not to be lonely is to have metta, because when you have metta for the world, it's really impossible to be lonely, because you kind of have all that inside of you that you're seeking from the outside. But if enough time passes, then even if you have a lot of metta, you eventually feel lonely, it seems. So you become dissatisfied and anxious. Oh, if only another being would come to this state of existence. Or if another being would come here, yeah, and visit me. Then another sentient beings, due to the running out of the lifespan of merit, pass away from that host of radiant deities and are also reborn in that empty mansion of Brahma in company with that first being. There they too are mind-made, feeding on rapture, self-luminous, moving through the sky, steadily glorious, and they remain like that for a very long time.
Abjan,
please.
Could you explain what
Mind-made means that you are just like a mind, yeah? So you are like a like in your dreams, yeah? Who are you in your dream? Yeah, that kind of character in your dreams, a bit like that, yeah? You're not really, your physical body is no longer there, but you are still around. Or if you are in the fantasy land, your mind is far away in some fantasy world, at that moment you are like a bit mind-made. Your character is no longer in your physical body, but you're off in some fantasy world. So in the same way, in these realms, you don't have a physical body like this. You may still have a very subtle body in some of these realms. Yeah, and so you have a body which is very light and very subtle. It may still be visible, etc. But it won't be a heavy body like this one. And the higher up you go in these realms, the more subtle your body is, until you lose your body altogether. And all that remains is the mind. Yeah, that's why you just have you have rapture. Yeah. You are, it says self-luminous here, so it sounds like there's a little bit of body left, yeah, because there's some kind of visual aspect left, but it's a very, very delicate and refined body that remains, yeah, and it's created by the mind, it's not, it doesn't have an existence of its own, yeah. Yes, Eddie.
Very interesting, Ajahn Brahmya, Brahmalinya.
Yeah.
As I interpret it, okay, like a mind at that, you know, in lower realms, we have that body, you know, okay? Mm. As you say, as you go higher up, there's no body, only the mind, the consciousness. Mm. And the consciousness floats, you know? Higher, as you go higher,
yeah.
The consciousness floats, you know?
Uh-huh.
And then you can float through the sky, as it says down there.
Mm. Yeah, I think if you say consciousness floats, it's a metaphor, because consciousness floating is something that a physical thing does, yeah? Once you talk about consciousness, you're no longer in that physical realm, so even floating is like a metaphor, because consciousness is just completely, it's immaterial, so you can't really talk about it quite in those words, but I know what you mean. So it's like a, yeah, it just exists on its own in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yes, please.
I just wonder, obviously it is consistently in the passages that there's still a sense of time.
So it seems, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah.
Even in the second jhana, there's a sense of time.
It depends on whether this is looked at from the point of view of the Buddha, he's telling the story, or whether it's looked at from the point of view of that person. Yeah, it's really hard to say. But here, we see people, they have a sense of longing. And of course, if you have a sense of longing, it means that you are not in a jhana state.
There's a sense of time.
Yeah, so there will be a sense of time, exactly. But if you are in a very, the higher your rebirth is, there comes a point, if you are in these states fully, then of course there's no sense of time, because there's no movement.
The time practically should slow down, right?
It's just disappear entirely.
Yeah, until there's no time, right?
Because time depends on change. Time depends on movement. Yeah, yeah.
So I'll expect there'll be more change in the Brahma realm than in the second jhana.
Yeah, exactly. So there'll be more sense of time in that Brahma mansion than in the second jhana realm. Yeah.
So, but in terms of the relative sense of time, is it still the same?
I don't think so. I think time tends to slow down. Yeah.
But within which the sense of time within that realm, just like these days is quite clear, right? The dog sense, our sense of the dog's life is short lived, right?
Yeah.
But the dog doesn't feel that it's that's his life, you know.
We probably don't know exactly how the dog feels, but
done quite an extensive study. The sense of relative sense of time is the same.
Absolutely, it would be relative, but it will still probably feel quite long. Yeah, I don't think that they feel like they live like a human life. They probably feel still very long, but it may not feel as long as it looks from the outsider.
Because when they look at the human life, it's pathetic. You
know? Yeah.
pathetic
is the right word. I mean, there's an interesting story. I've told this story before, but it's a really nice little story from the. This is about the time, how fast time goes in the Tavatimsa realm. So in Buddhism, you have the human realm. If some of you are new to the suttas, I apologize, because it may be quite hard for you to follow. Please don't be afraid of asking questions, if you're new to this. But so in Buddhism, you have the human realm, and then you have a number of kind of realms above that, often called heavenly realms. The first one is called the Chaturmaharajika Deva. Yeah, I use Pali words because it makes me sound very important and wise. Yeah? This means like the realm of the four great kings. And then you have the Tabatinsa Loka above that, which is the realm of the 33. Yeah. And in that Tabatinsa Loka, is it kind of, when we talk about being reborn in the heavenly realms, that's usually what we mean by being reborn in the heavenly realm, Tabatinsa Loka, because it's very pleasant compared to the human realm. And there's a story, I don't think it's in the suttas, but some kind of, this is a kind of nice story. And this is a story of a person who dies. Yeah, made a lot of good merit, gets reborn No, it's the other way around. It's a deva in the Tavatinsa Loka, yeah? And then dies in the Tavatinsa realm and gets reborn as a human, yeah? Gets reborn in the human realm and kind of, you know, does all the things, yeah, does what human beings do, but lives a good life. And after 100 years, that dies and gets reborn back into that heavenly realm where it came from. And then when he goes back there, yeah, the other devas say, oh, what happened to you? You've been away all day, yeah? Where have you been? What happened? And it's just been away for 100 years, according to the human realm. And that says something about the relativeness of time, yeah, in those realms. And that actually, from the Devaloka, it seems like a fairly short time. But in the human realm, 100 years seems like a long time. So in that sense, you're right, Huitong. It's actually, there is a degree of... But I think it's both. It both feels longer and it's relative. It is not just... It doesn't feel like exactly the same. Yeah, yeah. Absolutely, yeah. Otherwise, it doesn't make any sense, really. Exactly. Even for their own sense, it would be long. Yeah. Otherwise, it would be pathetic nonsense, as you say. Okay. That's a nice phrase, turn of words there. Okay, anyway. It doesn't fit with the idea of less suffering, etc. And the devil, look, I agree with you. So, yeah, absolutely, it is longer from their point of view as well. Okay, let's move on, because otherwise we're going to be stuck here and we're going to be dead before we get finished with this sutta. That would be also be pathetic. I don't mean to discourage you asking questions, but I may just... move on a little bit faster. Okay, so they remain there like that for a very long time. Now, that being who was reborn there first, that being thinks, I am Brahma, the great Brahma, the undefeated, the champion, the universal seer, the wielder of power, the Lord God, the maker, the author, the first, the begetter, the controller, the father of those who have been born and those yet to be born. These beings were created by me. Why is that? Because first I thought, oh, if only another being would come to this state of existence. Such was my heart's wish. And then these creatures came to this state of existence. Yeah, so that is how you get this idea of being God, yeah, being God. And you see here some of these ideas. Brahma in the Indian kind of cosmology is very equivalent to what Christianity has as God, or Islam has as Allah, or Judaism has as God. It's a very similar idea. And you can see it through these kind of ideas that you see here, yeah? First of all, you are... Let me have a look at the Pali again, because without the Pali, you are a bit lost with all of these terms. So you are the undefeated, yeah, the champion, the universal seer. Yeah, okay, so this is a bit different from how they talk about this in Christianity, but kind of, it's not kind of incompatible either with Christian ideas. You are the wielder of power, that kind of makes sense, yeah, the God is the kind of all-powerful. Isaro means like Lord or God. Yeah, Adansudato translates as the Lord God. You are the maker. Yeah, kata is the one who makes or creates. The author, this is nimata. Nimata also means creator. Yeah, you create the world. Again, the word creator is very, very similar to what you find in Christianity. You are the seto, which she translates as the first, but really it means the best also. Yeah, you are the best. And then you have another word which means like creator, which Bhantasiddhanta has here as the begetter. That's also like the creator. Yeah, you are the controller. You are the father. Yeah, you are the father, just like we say in Christianity. Father, thou who art in heaven, or whatever, however it goes. So all of these ideas are very, very similar to what you find in kind of all theistic religions, where you have one God who is behind this. So this critique that we are seeing here is a general critique of the idea of a creator God. Yeah, this is what we are seeing here. It is applicable to all religions that have a creator God, because the ideas here are very, very similar to what we find in all such religions. And of course, there is a reason for that. There's a reason why these ideas are similar. And the reason is that it kind of is there is a seed in human beings to believe in these kind of things. Yeah, the seed is the sense of self that we have already. We have a sense of self, and then we project that sense of self onto the universe in the sense of a creator God. Yeah, we already have a feeling of something being permanent, that which we take to be ourselves, then we project that onto the universe, and then we see a creator God in the universe. So it's kind of natural to have this idea. Yeah, and then that, of course, that an aspect of that self, very often with human beings, the aspect of the sense of self is the doer inside our creative abilities. We project that too onto the God. The God becomes the absolute powerful thing that kind of creates the universe. So this is one way in which this idea of a creator God arises in our society, and is explained through this kind of simile, this Buddhist legend, if you like. Yeah, and then it thinks that they have created these other people. Why? Well, because he thought, oh, I hope these beings come. Yeah, and as soon as he had that thought, sure enough, all these other beings got reborn there. And then he mistakenly thinks that it is the creator of these beings. And then those other beings who were reborn there later also think, this must be Brahma, the great Brahma, the undefeated, the champion, the universal seer, the wielder of power, the Lord God, the maker, the author, the first, the begetter, the controller, the father of those who have been born and those yet to be born. And we have been created by him. Why is that? Go away. Because we see that he was reborn here first, and we arrived afterwards. So everyone starts to think there is God. God thinks he is God mistakenly, and those who think that he is, and everyone else too thinks that he is God. It's kind of weird, isn't it? You get this kind of delusion arising here. And then what happens next? And the being who was reborn first is more long-lived, more beautiful and more illustrious than those who arrived afterwards. And that this is how things often are. Yeah, if someone kind of has very powerful personal qualities, and very often we tend to believe people like that more because of their qualities. So if someone is, you know, wealth, even in the human realm, wealthy and powerful and good looking and whatever else it is, if they have all those qualities together, they tend to sort of gain prominence in our society for some reason. And this is happening also in the heavenly realm. Why it is? Yeah. So you should be there and tell them off. Yeah, you should remind them that they have got it all wrong. Yeah. So, Bill, that's your job. Yeah, get reborn there and tell them, why are you thinking this? This doesn't make any sense. Yeah. I think one of the things is that human beings, we're not always logical. Yeah, we kind of go with all kind of feelings and emotions, all kind of things. And this is what comes afterwards. That it's not really, many of these views are not really logical as such. Yeah. Kuitong, yeah.
So does that mean that once you're reborn, say, into the Brahma Loka, right? that they have forgotten the previous life,
immediate
previous existence.
That's exactly right. Yeah, and this is why it's, you know, these things take a long, long time. And this is actually found in some other suttas that you, after a while, you forget that you were even reborn. You think you have been there forever because you've been there for so long. Yeah. So that actually shows you that the perception of time is very different from in the human realm. Yeah. Because you feel, oh, I can't even remember where I came from. I've been here forever.
Yeah.
And that's how you believe that you are. Yeah.
But on the other hand, I'm not sure if there are others, you know, saying that from human realm one is reborn to the Devaloka, right? The particular Deva could remember that the immediate past life in the human realm.
Yeah.
Is that right? Is that from the sutta?
It is, but in the lower Devalokas, you can probably remember that you got in there because they don't last that long. Yeah. So for each realm you go up, it's like a multiplication each time. So if you get reborn, say, in the lowest heavenly realm, then maybe the lifespan is 10 times a human being. Or not actually much more than that. It's maybe, 500 times, something like that. And then if you go one realm up, then it's kind of 10 times that again. Another realm, 10 times that again. So it goes up exponentially.
Yeah?
So once you get to the Brahma realms, it's going to be very, very long as a consequence. Like eons.
So you're saying moving up, it's indeed true that it's in the scripture that they could remember at least the immediate past life, right?
Yeah.
But moving down, then they lose that ability. I think this is obviously moving down.
Yeah, but all of these realms are so high that, you know, in all of these realms, you probably can't remember where you came from. So even if you had moved up from the Brahma mansion to the Abhasara, it wouldn't be the same problem, because both of those realms are incredibly long lasting. Yeah.
But obviously, it's still at least 10 times, quite a bit. Quite a bit disparate in terms of it's 10 times.
Yeah.
It's order of magnitude shorter.
Massively, very, very different. Yeah. Okay. Okay.
Am I right to say that in the sutta explained now, you know,
you've
now arrived at the 14th plane, the plane of great Brahma?
I haven't counted the planes, but anyway,
I think if we can look in this estimation, refer to the 31 planes.
Yeah.
For me, I refer to that.
Yeah.
You can see it more clearly. You know,
yeah.
That we have arrived now in the plane of great Brahma, 14th realm. Maybe you're going up, higher up.
Well, there are 10. Usually it's called 10 sensual realms, and above the 10 sensual realms, and you have the first Dharma realm, which is where the Brahma mansion would be. So it would be something around the 14th realm, maybe 12 or something like that. Yeah. But yeah. So we're high up in the heavenly realms, not kind of way up there, beyond the sensuality, etc. Yeah. Why he would be reborn in that realm?
With wrong view.
Because the kamma required for being reborn in this realm is jhana states, right? This is the equivalent of a jhana attainment. It's not the equivalent of right view. So you can be reborn in all the realms, in samsaric realms, with wrong view. Except for the Suddhavasa. The Suddhavasa called the pure abode. That's where you can get reborn as an anagami. But all these realms are available and still have wrong view. Okay. This is why these suttas take such a long time. You know? It's nice that you are all keen and ask questions. I do not mean to put you off. Okay. So then, what happens next? What happens next is the following. It is possible that one of those beings passes away from that host. In other words, passes away from the Brahma's mansion and is reborn in this state of existence. This state means human state. Having done so, they go forth from the lay life to homelessness. And by dint of keen, resolute, committed and diligent effort and right focus. Right focus is yoniso manasikara, by the way. They experience an immersion of the heart, a state of samadhi, of such a kind that they recollect that past life, but no further. Yeah, in other words, they recall the existence in the Brahma's mansion, but nothing beyond that, nothing before that. And then they say, because what they recall, of course, is this, they recall believing in God, yeah? They recall believing this kind of Brahma. They say, he who is Brahma, the great Brahma, the undefeated, the champion, the universal seer, the wielder of power, the Lord God, the maker, the author, the first, the begetter, the controller, the father, those who have been born, and those yet to be born. He is permanent, everlasting, eternal, imperishable, remaining the same for all eternity, yeah? Yeah, now it's really starting to sound like a god, right? Eternal and the creator of the universe. These are probably the foremost ideas of God in Christianity or all theistic religions. So you can see here how this comes to be. But we who were created by that Brahma, we are impermanent, not lasting, short-lived, perishable, and have come to this state of existence. This is the first ground on which some ascetics and Brahmins rely to assert that the self and the cosmos are partially eternal. So this is how this comes about. Yeah, it's kind of fascinating. And the question is, how literally should we take this? I don't really know. Maybe this is possible. I guess it is possible that this can happen in this way. But I think the main point of this is to remember that ideas of a creator God can arise out of some sort of strange events. Yeah, some things coming together in a certain way. And then the idea of a creator God kind of arises out of that. And I know it's very common in our society to think that, oh yeah, everybody believes in the creator God, so surely it must be true, because everyone else believes in it. And I think that is one of the worst reasons for believing in something, because everyone else believes in it. Because if you look at the average human being, they don't know what they're doing. Yeah, it's true, isn't it? We're all fumbling around in the darkness trying to find our way through this. And just because the average person believes in God has no bearing on whether there is a God or not. But sometimes we are kind of persuaded by these kind of arguments. Yeah, 2 billion people believe in God. Yeah, cheapest. Maybe I'm missing out on something here. But actually, that is not a very good reason for believing in things. So these things, they arise in strange ways. And because the idea of a creator God is kind of fits with our defilements, it fits with our tendencies, it fits with our sense of, you know, our own sense of wanting to live on for the future, wanting to be safe and wanting to go to a nice realm afterwards, it kind of feeds into our own defilements. It feeds into our own wrong views. Yeah, for many people anyway, not for everyone, but for many people. And because it feeds into that, it is feels nice for many people to have this idea of a creator God. And this is kind of the disturbing thing with this. The disturbing thing is that very often the views that we have about the world, we have them because they feel right. They feel good to us. Yeah, not because we are logical about it. Not because this kind of makes sense from any point of view. But because it just feels good. And so we should be very careful when we hear a view that kind of fits with our own defilements. Yeah, and be very careful, because defilements are very profound. Then you should be careful. You should think twice before you accept that view, because it's a kind of a warning sign. It fits with my defilement. Yeah, I'll take it on board. Okay, wait a minute. Maybe something dodgy going on here. True, and they still have that defilement. Yeah, the defilement is the defilement of wrong view, the delusion that they have. So it's still there, and it's true. And that makes it even more dangerous, right? Because it means that they're very easy to listen to people like that, because they seem exceptional in so many ways. And that's more easy to be led astray by individuals that are so powerful, yet have wrong view. Yeah, it's a very good point.
Yeah.
They have these qualities and they have an immediate relationship with the God or the vision of the God.
Yeah, yeah. So that is the thing. That so sometimes you're quite right. Sometimes some of these prophets in the world, they are people who have had some kind of special experience. It could be a samadhi experience. It could be something else. And then based on that, because they're very charismatic and they draw people in, then they start a religion on that basis and you get a religion going. So this is why it's so tricky. Yeah, it can be very, very tricky, this whole realm of spirituality and religion. And the only way you're going to find your way through this is to be very, very honest and look very, very carefully and not to take things for granted and all these kind of things. Then you can kind of find your way through the jungle somehow. Yeah?
Could Buddha was trying to explain this could happen and about these prophets and their view?
I think he is. He is. That's what he is doing. Yeah, yeah. That's what essentially what he's doing here. He's saying that these people who have these kind of things often become prophets. So he's saying in all these cases you have to be careful with what you're listening to. You should always And it's interesting because one of the things you can see here this person who has this meditational experience of remembering a God in the past life, what they think to be a creator God, they draw the conclusion that this creator God is eternal. But you're drawing that conclusion on very flimsy evidence. There is no evidence of eternity. All there is the evidence of some being that was there that you think created you. And then you go way outside the evidence to say that this person or this being is eternal. And I think this is always true. Yeah, if you have the idea of a eternal God, there is no experience that can tell you something is eternal. It's impossible because all experiences are limited. All experiences are short. No experience can actually be equivalent to eternity. So the idea of an eternal God or a creator God is always going to be based on some kind of speculation, some kind of ideas in your mind that cannot be based on experience because there is no experience like that. So when people say that, oh, I've experienced God, well, it means that they've experienced something that was very powerful, but they have not experienced something that is eternal because that is impossible. Such an experience does not exist. That's kind of interesting, isn't it? I find that so interesting. Yeah? Because what that means is that many of the gods that we talk about in Buddhism, the devas of Sakka and the Brahma we have here, gods that are impermanent, that last for a certain time, well, these are the things you can experience. Yeah, these are the things that make sense within the bounds of what experiences are possible. Yeah, or the Nordic gods, favorite gods, Thor and Odin, those guys. Or the Greek gods, all of this kind of polytheistic teaching that have existed in humanity, all of those actually are more closely aligned with what is possible in human experience than the idea of an eternal God that created the universe. So there's much more grounds for believing in all of these polytheistic gods, yeah? Much more grounds for believing in that than for believing in an eternal God. Anyway, Eddie.
Yeah, it just came to my mind, There was, when I was with BGF, this story, okay, yeah. There was Buddha and Great Brahma met, okay? And Great Brahma said, "Oh no, I'm the greatest. I'm the creator God. So what happened was they decided to play hide and seek. Hide and seek. Yeah. So have you heard this thing?
It's in the Majjhima Nikaya 48.
Yeah, that's all. Yeah, yeah.
Brahma Nimantika Sutta.
Yeah. And then Great Brahma said, "Okay, I'll hide this thing, Buddha. Yeah. Then you find me. And then when he went, Great Brahma went to hide. Buddha said, "Oh, there you are, Great Brahma. I can see you. So when it came to Buddha's time, when Buddha okay, now it's your turn to hide. So Buddha hid this thing, and Great Brahma tried to find him. Where are you, Buddha? I can't find you. Because he's at the higher plane. he can travel to the 31 plane, this thing. Mm. Great Brahma is only on the 14th plane. Is it in the Sutta, is it?
Mm. Yeah, oh, in the Brahma, so Madhyamanikaya, 48 or 49, I guess maybe 49, Brahma Nimantika Sutta, the invitation of Brahma. Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah. Look it up when you come back, Eddie. Yeah. Okay. So that's the first ground. Or the fifth ground, really, because we had four before. And this is like the partial eternalism. It's called partial eternalism because there is one being considered eternal and other beings considered mortal and short-lived. Shall we carry on a little bit? Yeah, you're okay? Yeah? So I'll just carry on a little bit. And what is the second ground on which they rely? There are gods named depraved by play, or corrupted by play. They spend too much time laughing, playing, and making merry. And in doing so, they lose their mindfulness, and they pass away from that host of gods. So, depraved here doesn't really mean depraved in the ordinary sense. It just means that you become a bit corrupted, yeah? You kind of lose your senses a little bit. That's really all it means, because there's nothing really wrong with laughing and playing and making merry. It's just that if you go too far, and if you go too far, it says here, you lose your mindfulness. The Pali word here is sati. And why does losing your mindfulness make you pass away? It seems a bit strange. Surely these gods aren't mindful all the time. No one is mindful all the time except maybe an arahant. And I think this translation here is a little bit unfortunate, because sati does not just mean mindful, it also means memory. So what you do is you become forgetful. I think this is kind of the idea here. Yeah, you become forgetful. And the commentary specifically says that what it means is that you become forgetful, so you forget to eat. Yeah, you're just wandering around, you're having a good time, and in the heavenly realm, because your body is very subtle, if you don't eat, you can die just like that, and then you pass away from that realm. So forgetfulness is kind of dangerous in that realm. You have to make sure you get nourishment for your subtle body in time, otherwise you are off to a new place very quickly. So you pass away from that host of gods. Anyway, that's the idea there. There's just different ways of dying, yeah? And it's a different, that's kind of what that is about. So, what happens next? It is possible that one of those beings passes away from that realm and is reborn in this state of existence, in the human realm. Having done so, they go forth from the lay life to homelessness, and by dint of keen, resolute, committed, and diligent effort and right focus, they experience a stillness of the mind of such a kind that they recollect that past life, but no further. Yeah, we're getting used to these ideas now. And then they say, the gods who are not depraved by play don't spend so much time laughing, playing, and making merry. So they don't become forgetful, and they don't pass away from that host of gods. They are permanent, everlasting, eternal, imperishable, remaining the same for all eternity. But we who were depraved by play spent too much time laughing, playing, and making merry. In doing so, we became forgetful and passed away from that host of gods. We are impermanent, not lasting, short-lived, perishable, and have come to this state of existence. This is the second ground on which some ascetics and Brahmins rely to assert the self and the cosmos are partially eternal. So this is maybe a little bit strange, but I guess again the idea is just to show various ways in which the idea of eternalism kind of creeps in. Yeah. So the idea here is that if you don't lose your mindfulness, as long as you don't forget to eat, you'll be fine. And then you can go on forever and you are eternal as a consequence. But if you are forgetful, then you are impermanent and you die from that realm. So I'm not sure if that is real permanence or not, because eventually I guess everyone forgets, but anyway, that's the way it goes. And this is a slightly an unusual kind of view, because here you have a bunch of gods. All of them are presumably permanent, except for those who pass away, who are impermanent. So you have like a lot of permanent gods, and you have a number of impermanent beings. So I'm not sure how that works out, but that's kind of the idea behind this. Maybe those permanent gods ultimately kind of belong to one godhead or one kind of higher deity, a Brahma or something, and they kind of merge in that ultimately. I'm not sure exactly what the idea here is, but the idea is just this is a way of thinking about eternalism and non-eternalism. Does this make any... Does this... Good, yeah. It's entertaining anyway, at least, but does it make sense to anyone, this kind of ideas? Does it kind of... Is it something that you can believe in, or yeah? Okay, yeah, good.
Excuse me, John.
Yeah?
If you come down from a higher realm to the human realm, it seems that you become a monk.
Yeah. Yeah. The idea is just that occasionally there will be someone who becomes a monk or nun. Yeah. There probably are millions of people going through the process of disappearing from those realms, and one in a million becomes a monk or a nun, and then they go forth and then have this experience. Actually, not one in a million, and you have to have 1,000 monks, yeah, or nuns, to actually do the meditation to recall their past life. One of those 1,000 then have that recollection. It's only a tiny minority, but it happens to it. If you have enough time and enough beings, eventually there's going to be someone this happens to. That's kind of the point here. Yeah.
Well, the way I read it, it seems that all the beings that come from a higher realm, go into the light.
Yeah. No, I don't think that's the point. Let's see what it says here. It's possible, yeah. First of all, it's possible, right? That's the first word there. You see there? It's possible. In other words, it may happen occasionally, yeah? Yeah? That one of those beings, not many of them, one of those beings passes away from that host and is reborn in the human realm. Yeah, so that's really the point there. It's perhaps once in the blue moon, as I say, yeah, this will happen. Yeah.
Okay, thank you for correcting me.
You are very welcome, Bill. Okay, let's move on to the third ground. Go away. Nola. Ajahn Siddhartha, you have to do something with this website. Okay, what is the third ground on which they rely? And there are gods named malevolent. They spend too much time gazing at each other, so they grow angry with each other, and their bodies and minds get tired. They pass away from that host of gods. It is possible... That is not certain, Bill. It's possible that one of those beings passes away from that host and is reborn in this state of existence. Having done so, they go forth from the lay life to the homelessness. And by dint of keen, resolute, and committed, and diligent effort, and right focus, they experience a stillness of the mind of such a kind that they recollect that past life but no further. They said those gods who are not malevolent don't spend too much time gazing at each other, so they don't grow angry with each other, their bodies and minds don't get tired, and they don't pass away from that host of gods. They are permanent, everlasting, eternal, imperishable, remaining the same for all eternity. But we who were malevolent spent too much time gazing at each other. We grew angry with each other, our bodies and minds got tired, and we passed away from that host of gods. We are impermanent, not lasting, short-lived, perishable, and have come to this state of existence. This is the third ground on which some ascetics and Brahmins rely to assert the self and the cosmos are partially eternal. So if you get too angry and you do too many bad things, your body gets tired, maybe you lose that energy that required to be a god, and then bang, you pass away as a consequence. So. Okay, one more ground before we call it a afternoon. This is the last one of the partial eternalist views, and we'll just do this one and we can continue with the next, because it's come in groups of four, so it's kind of handy to do the fourth view as well. What is the fourth ground on which they rely? It's when some ascetic or Brahmin relies on logic and inquiry. They speak of what they have worked out by logic, following a line of inquiry, expressing their own perspective. That which is called the eye, the ear, or the nose, or the tongue, or the body, that self is impermanent, not lasting, transient, and perishable. But that which is called mind, or sentience, or consciousness, that self is permanent, everlasting, eternal, imperishable, remaining the same for all eternity. This is the fourth ground that they rely on. So this is like just a logic, and it's kind of a natural logic, yeah, when you consider human beings, we can see that the body with the senses, when you die, it just rots and disappears. It kind of makes sense. But the idea then that the mind being released from that body, the spirit kind of carrying on, is kind of one of those very typical ideas that we also have in humanity. So they make a distinction between the physical body on the other hand, with all the characteristics of the physical body, and the mind on the other hand. That's kind of the idea here. And that mind they take to be permanent. It's kind of a reasonable thing to think. Yeah. Now what is interesting about this, and a very important point here, this is the eighth view we have come to now, four today, and we had another four 8 months ago, whatever, so this is the eighth one. And this is the sentence, that thing which is called mind or sentience or consciousness. These three words, mind, sentience and consciousness, these three words are citta, mano and vijnana in Pali. This is a very important point of the Pali, because it's very common, you know, it's very, as everywhere, in all kinds of religion, even in Buddhism, people want to find a way of saving some kind of permanent entity inside, yeah, for human beings. Somewhere we can go afterwards, we can be happy, we can hang out with, yeah. And very often they make a distinction between, yeah, mind, everyone knows that, you know, everyone knows that consciousness is impermanent, yeah, but mind, yeah, that the Buddha doesn't really say mind is impermanent. So mind, that kind of carries on afterwards, although consciousness disappears, yeah. So they will use one of these words to say that they are different from the other words. But what we see here is we see that these words are essentially referring to the same thing. Yeah, the thing, that thing, which we call mind, citta, or mano, or vijnana, that thing which has these different names, it is called by these different names, that thing is permanent, everlasting, etc. That is the wrong view. So these are synonymous. They are used in the same way to refer to the same kind of thing, which really is the knower inside. Yeah, vijnana, citta, and mano. And once you know that making a distinction between these things is really impossible. And when you think about it, it makes good sense. Yeah, I mean, you cannot really have mind without consciousness. What would mind without consciousness be? It means you can't know anything with your mind. It kind of becomes like a rock or something like that. It doesn't make any sense. Also, if you do have consciousness, well, you will have to have mind. Yeah, because if you are conscious, you're always conscious of something. The mind, all the aspects of mind, come with that consciousness. Mano, which is also another word for mind, really, actually very closely related to the word mind in English, mano, mind, that also is here used in the same way. So all of these main words that relate to mental activity are here said to be roughly equivalent. So why is there this distinction? Why do we have these three words? Well, and the reason is because the Buddha, you know, he used the vocabulary of ancient India to a certain effect. And he would use these words in slightly different contexts. So when we're talking about the five khandhas, for example, yeah, the five khandhas are five aspects of personality. Yeah, we have rupa, vedana, sanya, sankara, and vijnana. The fifth khanda is vijnana, consciousness. So when you want to, when the Buddha wants to kind of focus on the idea of knowing, like he does with the five khandhas, then he uses the word consciousness. If he wants to focus on the idea of mind as a general thing that has feelings and perceptions and consciousness and all of this, then he uses the word citta to mean that. This kind of general idea of mind. And when he wants to talk about the five senses, sight, hearing, smelling, tasting, and touching, the last sense is the mind sense. So when he wants to distinguish the mind sense from the other five senses, then he used the word mano. So they have kind of, they're slightly specialized areas, but at the same time, they're also synonyms for each other. They don't actually mean different things, they are synonymous. And this is one of these very interesting passages in the suttas for this particular point of view, because here we are talking about wrong views, This is kind of the whole purpose of the sutta. So this idea that mind, sentience, consciousness, citta, mano, vijnana, is everlasting and permanent, it is wrong. This is what it says right here. Huh? And of course, once you start to know the suttas, you know that this is really the message in so many places in the suttas. Huh? So that kind of eternalism is also wrong, according to the Buddha. So let's just finish off this section. You are very welcome to leave if you are exhausted already, but if you want to stay, you're also very welcome to stay. So I will just finish this off. This is the fourth ground on which some ascetics and Brahmins rely to assert that the self and the cosmos are partially eternal. These are the four grounds on which those ascetics and Brahmins assert that the self and the cosmos are partially eternal and partially not eternal. Any ascetics or Brahmins who assert that the self and cosmos are partially eternal or partially not eternal do so on one or other of these four grounds. Outside of this, there is none. This is supposed to be a complete explanation of partial eternalism. And I don't know. I mean, some philosophers have argued that maybe you can construct other ways of thinking about this, and maybe you can. But the point is that there is no doctrine of partial eternalism that is going to work. That's really the point of this. The realized one understands this. If you hold onto and attach to these four grounds for views, it leads to such and such a destiny in the next life. So the idea here is that if you have these kind of views, and you attach to these views, and usually most people will attach to the views, then actually the consequence of that is rebirth. Why? Well, because whenever you have a view, whenever there is attachment, there is a degree of craving, a degree of desire involved with that attachment. If someone challenges your view and you are attached to it, you're going to defend yourself. You might get upset. You might get angry. You might, whatever, because this is your view. It's part of who you are. You identify with this. And whatever you identify with, you're going to get upset if people challenge you. So whenever there is attachment to views, it actually is rebirth leading. It drives you on in samsara. And this is why the Buddha said we should not attach to views ultimately. This is kind of the problem here. So the Buddha, he understands this, and he understands what goes beyond this. Yet since he does not misapprehend that understanding, he has realized extinguishment within himself. So he understands the problem of views, and he understands that which goes beyond. I guess any views that go beyond, and also what goes beyond the views themselves. In other words, not views as such, because everyone has views, even the Buddha has views, but the attachment to the view, that's the problem. That's a very important distinction, because sometimes you will hear that in Buddhism one shouldn't have any views. That's actually not correct. It's not views aren't wrong. It's the attachment to the view that is the problem. Yeah, it's important to have views because you have to have something to guide you in life. In fact, you cannot live without views. Even the view, I have no views, is a view. Actually, that view is found in the suttas. The view, I have no views. And the Buddha says, well, but isn't that view of yours, isn't that a view that you have no views? Huh. And that's, if you want to read about that one, look up Majjhimanikaya 674. The Diganaka Sutta is about the a cousin of when the Sariputta goes to the Buddha, and that's what it tells the Buddha. It's a very nice little discussion actually here. So he understands that and understands what goes beyond. But since he does not misapprehend that understanding, misapprehend is the wrong translation. I'm terribly sorry, Bhante Sujato. I hope you listen to this. There's absolutely no chance that he's listening to this. But if you were to listen to this, please change this translation. because the Pali word just means grasp. It means hold on to. So because it does not hold on to that understanding, he does not hold on to that as a view, he has realized extinguishment, yeah, nibbana within himself. So to let go of all views and all grasping, all holding on, well, that is one of the definitions of nibbana, yeah, of becoming an arahant. Having truly understood the origin, the ending, the gratification, the drawback, and the escape from feelings, the realized one is freed through not grasping here. So here we come back to the idea of feelings again. Yeah? And this is kind of very fascinating, because you may wonder, why does the Buddha talk about views and suddenly he brings up feelings? I think this is related to what I was saying initially, is that views usually arise from feelings. If someone tells you that you're going to be eternal and you like that idea, if it feels good for you, you will say, yeah, I'll take that view. Yeah, I'll believe in the Creator God or whatever. So we tend to follow our feelings, whatever feels good to us. You know, if you ask a Buddhist monk, why are you a Buddhist monk? And he might say, because it feels good. That's kind of scary, yeah? Because it feels good, jeepers. I thought I was being smart and doing the right thing. Yeah? And this kind of makes you check your choices much more a second time to make sure you don't just do it for some silly reason, but you have good grounds for doing so. Huh? And so, because the Buddha understands the origin of these feelings, and feelings, of course, where do they come from? Well, they come from contact. They come from our experience of the world. When you see something, yeah, you contact the world through the eye. When you hear something, you contact the world through the ear. And every time you have an experience, there is a feeling that arises with that experience. And that feeling then, given the right circumstances, will then give rise to views. Yeah. So if you understand the underlying feeling, you also understand the problem of views. Kind of interesting, isn't it? That views can actually be kind of... You can take it back to feelings, and if you understand the whole feeling thing, well, actually, that is where you also let go of the grasping, holding on to views. So you understand the origin of those feelings, they're coming from contact of the world. And of course, contact is always changing, and because it's always changing, it means the feelings are always changing. When the contact ends, then the feeling ends as a consequence. And you understand the gratification, the pleasure in that feeling, in that view. You understand the danger, the pressure, of course, makes you feel happy, yeah, happy feeling. The drawback is it will change. And then you understand the escape, because you understand it's not worth holding on to. Huh? And then you are freed through not grasping. Huh? These are the principles, deep, hard to see, especially when the thing comes down, hard to see, hard to understand, peaceful, sublime, beyond the scope of logic, subtle, comprehensible to the astute, to the wise, which the realized one makes known after realizing them with his own insight. And those who genuinely praise the realized one would rightly speak of these things. So this is why it is called deep, profound, sublime, because all of these things have to do with the insight into non-self. Yeah? It's only when you understand non-self through your own experience when you see that these eternalist teachings are basically an aspect of wrong view, and they cannot actually be right. That's why they are so profound, and that is what the Buddha should be praised for, not for doing the right, living the right way, and all these kind of things. But this is the profound reasons. Okay, I think I have to stop there. Otherwise, we might get some complaints. I'm sorry it was so short, but that's somehow this is how it goes. I hope you don't mind that we're doing these shorts. I quite like to do it thoroughly and well, rather than kind of going through this. But if you have any suggestions and you think that it's going too short, or if you think it's going too fast, maybe, I don't know, if you think it's going whatever, please let me know, and then we can take it from there. Any last minute questions or complaints or anything? Comments? Yes. Okay, let's take that again with the microphone.
I'm just wondering, is it fair to say that the mind will die without sati?
The mind will die without sati?
Yeah, because they're impermanent. You say the mind and the consciousness are impermanent.
Yeah. The impermanence is... excellent. The impermanence is there, even if you have sati. Yeah, it doesn't change the impermanence. So if you are, the ideal way of dying is to die with sati, with mindfulness. So you still die, if there's not sati there. But it's a better way of dying if you have sati. But in this case, there were some, it was a bit different. If you have, it says that you die when you have no mindfulness there. I think it's a slightly different thing that it talks about there in that sutta. It was more about, as I said, I think it's more about you forget to do the right thing, basically, and you die because of that. Sati, I think it has to do with forgetfulness rather than mindfulness. I think it means, like it said, you forget something, you forget to eat, and then you die because you forget to eat. Because it doesn't make any sense that you forget, that you die because you just lose your mindfulness, because, mindfulness is irrelevant. You still die, even if you have mindfulness. It doesn't make any difference as far as I'm concerned, Okay. Happy? Yeah, okay. Let's do one more question from the outsider. From Indira. Hello, Indira. Ajahn, is this sutta recorded in the same form in other traditions? Because there are some ambiguous phrases with metta. Yes, it is. There is a version of the sutta in existing in Chinese. I should have mentioned that because it's useful to know the parallels, to know that we are dealing with authentic suttas. And I cannot remember now which school that sutta belongs to, but I think it might be the Dharmaguptaka school, which is one of the ancient schools of India. Could be the Sarvastivada. I think it's Dharmaguptaka. And I have looked at that sutta just briefly, just to compare it with this one, and it's surprisingly similar. The stories are almost exactly the same. Everything is almost exactly the same. So for that reason, I think that probably what we have is quite authentic. It's probably quite original. Probably goes back. Most of this probably goes back to the time of the Buddha himself. So I was surprised to see that myself, because sometimes when you're dealing with stories and these kind of things, sometimes you have mistakes in transmission and things are not really kept quite intact, but it turns out to actually be quite surprisingly intact and surprisingly well kept.
Let me see if I can bring it up here, because I have it here actually, but fortunately I have it in translation, not in Chinese characters, because I cannot read Chinese characters. This is one of the things I would have loved to be able to read, but I guess you have to be satisfied sometimes with what you can do in one life. So I've got it right here. What is it? It's called the Fan Dong Jing. Does that make any sense for you? Fan Dong Jing?
No, it is called Fan Dong Jing.
Yeah?
The neck of the dog.
Ah, okay. Literally.
Okay. Covers everything. Okay. Fan Dong. So that means the Netto Brahma, right? Fan Dong Jing. Fan Dong Jing. Fan Huang Jing. Huang. Okay. Which one is Brahma? Fan is Brahma. Oh, okay. Okay. Is that a translation? Or is it a transliteration? Or Fan? Yeah. It also means. Yeah. Okay. Okay. It's a transliteration or something. Okay. Okay. Anyway, I'm not going to go into that. This is a translation by someone called Cheng Jianhua, saying something like that. Yeah. Okay. Anyway, let's call it a day. Let's just pay respect to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha and then.